Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Recent Advances in Medical Oncology, with a particular emphasis on the recent ASCO virtual meeting. Today, we'll be chatting about recent advances in multiple myeloma. We have an outstanding faculty of Dr. Kumar and Dr. Rajay. And I thought maybe just to sort of get warmed up before we dive into that, I want to ask a couple questions of the audience. And here's where we're heading. We're going to spend about half the time talking about what the way myeloma is treated nowadays, the existing tools that we have, the FDA approvals. And the second part will be more on where we're heading. But again, just before we kind of get into that, I just want to sort of take the pulse of the audience today and briefly just ask you, first of all, what the severity, and you can just click on whatever answer you think is appropriate. What's the severity of the COVID pandemic where you're located? One, for not being very affected at all, but five, very severely affected, such as what's seen with New York. And just looking at it, it looks like the majority of the audience is not answering one. So it looks like it's affecting everybody to some extent. And then there's another follow-up question I wanted to ask, and then I want to see what the faculty has to say about it. It looks like the majority of the audience now is having some impact of the pandemic, and a quarter of the audience saying five, interestingly enough. So a related question I'm just curious about, and maybe we'll cross-tab this later, has your approach to use of a stem cell transplant, upfront stem cell transplant myeloma, changed because of the COVID-19 pandemic? So while they're answering, I want to start with you, Newport, because, you know, certainly Boston and New York were two of the places that had the biggest problem earlier on. MGH in particular really had an amazing, they set up the whole unit there with COVID and cancer patients. It looks like more than two-thirds of the audience has had some effect, at least in terms of bone marrow transplant. What's been going on at your place? We were working with Ola Landgren from Memorial last week, and he was saying that they had held off on transplants. What's going on at MGH, Nupur?
So we've opened up again, Neil, as you can imagine. And the good news is the Northeast is obviously on a downward swing, which is a good thing for COVID-19. We were obviously very badly impacted when it came to March and April. And during those times, we did hold off on transplant, where we were evaluating transplant more as an elective option. We have started stem cell collections, and we've opened up our transplant unit now, and we are actually doing autologous transplants as well. So we had to prioritize appropriately, which we did do, and now we are back to a phase of opening up.
Any comments, Saji, not just what's going on at your place, but also any concerns you have about using any types of anti-myeloma therapies in areas that have a lot of COVID, you know, immune modulatory agent, I don't know what, anything in general that concerns you? And again, what's going on in your area in terms of transplants?
Right. So in terms of transplant, we did slow down when the pandemic originally started. We just limited patients to collect the stem cells so that we don't compromise their ability to collect later. But now we have opened up, and a lot of those patients who are waiting all this time have started coming back into the transplant process. In terms of specific drugs, there is really no data to support, you know, or to suggest that any one drug is going to be going to impact the or adversely impact the outcome of a COVID infection. In fact, if anything, there is data with the low dose dexamethasone suggesting that patients who receive low dose dexamethasone actually have better outcome in the hospitalized setting, at least. That was one of the initial concerns, that, you know, immunosuppressing them with steroids, maybe we should not do that. Obviously, these are different doses, but I think in general, I would say we should just continue with the therapy, minimizing the interactions they need to have with the healthcare system, but still managing to keep the myeloma under control. I think a relapse disease is probably more of a danger at this point, both from a disease itself and COVID.
So we're going to move on now and talk about some of the data that's come out related to myeloma, particularly at the ASCO meeting. And I'd say a plenary presentation would be pretty important at any ASCO meeting. And actually, Saji, gave the pre-season much awaited endurance trial presentation. He goes through this in detail in his talk, but I just want to kind of get into some of the high points and get Nupur's reaction to it. It's been really interesting to ask about people's reaction to this data set. So we'll start with Saji. Can you just, first of all, comment a little bit on the design of the study? There have been, and actually Dr. Landgren was commenting on this, you know, I'm going to say some concerns about the fact that patients could go to transplant or have their therapy switched. Any comments about the way the trial was designed, Saji?
Right. So, you know, the trial design is always a little bit of compromise between what is practical and what is the, you know, the absolutely perfect design. So this trial was designed with two questions in mind. One was, is carfilzomib Lendex a better combination compared to bortezomib Lendex based on phase two trials showing high rates of deep responses with carfilzomib Lendex. The second question was the ideal duration of maintenance therapy in the non-transplant setting. The current standard is to treat the patients until progression, and we don't necessarily know if that is the right approach. So the first randomization included newly diagnosed patients, almost 1,100 patients randomized to carfilzomib Lendex versus bortezomib Lendex. Endpoint was progression-free survival. Advantage for either of the regimens. The second randomization is indefinite maintenance compared to 24 months of maintenance. Here, the endpoint is actually an overall survival difference because that we felt is really what should be the gold standard if you're talking about duration of therapy.
So Nupur, of course, the big initial story here was the fact that there wasn't much difference in efficacy, although the depth of response looked a little bit better with KRD. Any comments on that before we go back to Saji? Nupur, what were your thoughts about this?
Sure. So I think this was a great randomized trial, comparing nearly 500 patients. A few caveats to the presentation. When we talk about RVD and KRD, these are classic regimens for sort of the transplant eligible patient population, and this was a transplant deferred patient population. So a lot of the older patient population was included here because it was a transplant deferred patient population. And at least the dosing schedule, which Saji has used in the endurance trial, we've always supported the use of RVD light in the older patient population. So I would have done it probably a little bit differently in the elderly patient population. And the other thing which I do think needs to be highlighted, and this was the design of the trial. So, high-risk patients were excluded from the study. So with these two caveats out there, obviously RVD versus KRD, there was no real difference despite the fact that the depth of response was better with KRD. And that was largely toxicity related, but I'd love to hear what Saji thinks about the fact that most of that toxicity, especially with the KRD arm, was in the older patient population, which may have then impacted the lack of superiority of the KRD arm in this patient population.
That's a really interesting point. And I was always looking forward from the day I heard about this trial to see the toxicity findings. I never really, Saji, got it figured out. I haven't talked to many people about this sort of dyspnea experience that a lot of people with carfilzomib have, and I think we got a lot of granularity on that as well as the neuropathy. Any comments, Saji?
Yeah, no, I think it's important when you look at the toxicity profile, as Nupur said, that probably explains to a large extent some of the lack of difference that we saw. So neuropathy, as expected, we did see comparable rates, about 6% of grade 3 peripheral neuropathy, which is what we have seen with other trials using subcutaneous formulation. Clearly, we'd used a twice weekly schedule because that was the standard of care when we designed the trial. And if we were to use subcutaneous, would the results have been different? Hard to say anything at this point. But the toxicities that were seen with carfilzomib-Lentex, especially the cardiac, renal, and pulmonary, was not a surprise in the sense because this was seen in other carfilzomib trials too, particularly to emphasize the Clarion trial, which used carfilzomib, melphalan, prednisone against bortezomib, melphalan, prednisone, and came out with the same result, saying that carfilzomib and bortezomib performed equally well in that older patient population. But clearly here, you know, we see a lot of hypertension, certainly, you know, in these patients, heart failure and acute kidney injury. Many of those toxicities can delay therapy considerably, and that could have played a role in terms of overall decreasing the long-term efficacy of that triplet.
Nupur, what did you think about the conclusion? I think if I understood it correctly, that VRD was still sort of standard of care. And it looks like VRD is the control arm in a lot of other studies moving forward. Any thoughts, Nupur?
No, I think the data speaks for itself. I think VRD for standard risk patients certainly did not seem to be any less effective than KRD. I think the big question is going to be if you take a transplant eligible patient population and include both high risk as well as standard risk patients, we may see differences. I always argue against risk stratifying based on genetics, but you know, Shaji is the one who has the M-SMART criteria where they use carfilzomib for their high-risk patients. So maybe we would see a slightly different outcome. I don't know. But certainly in the transplant-eligible patient population, I would still totally consider KRD. We are looking at using KRD in slightly different ways, doing weekly carfilzomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, so a different schedule to what was used in the endurance trial.
So Saji, you know, the way we do our consensus is that our group is we ask 25 people what they do, and if they all do the same thing, then we go, okay, that's a consensus. And a lot of times that doesn't happen. I will say when you make the patient high risk, investigators tend to use more KRD. Any comment on management of the high risk patient? We saw some more data at ASCO. We saw elotuzumab, Saji. Anything out there exciting in terms of higher risk patients in terms of induction?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question in the sense what it seems to have be working for the high-risk patients is the depth of response. And obviously, we don't have prospective trials showing that getting to a particular depth of response would alter the outcome for a given patient. But people with high-risk disease who get a deep response are the ones who do better. So I think we have to continue to work towards getting effective regimens which can give you a very deep response, whether it be, you know, we saw good data with KRD Dara from the MASTER trial that Dr. Costa presented, as well as some data in all comers, you know, standard risk and high-risk patients also from the EHA presentations from the European groups. So I think there's clearly, you know, the four drug regimens might be the way to go for some of those high-risk patients. Now, the question is, when you use those four drug regimens, should it be K or should it be V? And we don't really have the answer to that question.
And I guess the other thing is just in the non-high-risk situation, Nupur, a question of how those patients are going to be managed. And again, you know, we just ask people what they do. And, you know, one of the things that comes up is the idea of DRVD. And your colleague, Sagar Lonial, who we're going to be working with on Thursday, I can tell you that's what his preferred approach is. Saji, can you talk a little bit about the Griffin study and whether or not this is an approach you're using right now outside a trial setting?
Right. So the Griffin study is an important study in the setting of the U.S. practice. So to put it into perspective, the Europeans did a trial called the Cassiopeia trial, again, almost 1,100 patients who were randomized to a daratumumab VTD regimen versus VTD, which, again, was a main induction therapy for the European groups. And that trial also randomized patients to getting a daratumumab maintenance versus no maintenance after transplant and two cycles of three or four drug combination consolidation. So the Griffin trial is a mirror image of that. It's essentially replacing the thalidomide with the lenalidomide. So given that VRD is the preferred standard of care induction therapy in the U.S., this randomized to daratumumab RVD versus RVD transplant, consolidation for two cycles, maintenance with the daratumumab and len versus len. And as you can see with the from this slide, adding the daratumumab clearly improved the depth of response in these patients. Obviously, the data is too early to really call out survival outcomes yet, but I think this tells us two things. One, obviously, it is something that's feasible to do pre-transplant. And second, clearly the endpoint of deep response, the stringent complete response, was significantly better with daratumumab RVD versus RVD. I think before we routinely use this as our standard injection therapy before transplant, I certainly would like to see some survival outcome data.
So a couple of quick questions from the audience, Saji. When carfilzomib is used frontline for transplant-eligible patients, have you seen problems with stem cell collection?
No, they haven't been. We haven't noticed any impact on stem cell collection with a carfilzomib-based regimen.
So here's another one, Nupur from the audience. Does depth of response before transplant matter?
For sure. I think the one thing we've shown over the last several years is the deeper the response, the better the outcome. And it doesn't matter whether it's MRD, whether it's stringent CR. This is something we've known about myeloma for years. And patients who are already in a stringent CR prior to the transplant have a better outcome.
Let's talk about the other regimen that's gotten a lot of attention, really seems to be affecting practice, Saji. The daratumumab-len-dex combination. Can you comment about what we know about that and how it's affecting your practice?
Right. So I think considering, you know, starting off with VRD being the standard injection, the question was, can we replace the bortezomib with a monoclonal antibody that appears to be quite effective? So the MAIA trial was designed to randomize newly diagnosed transplant-ineligible patient population to daratumumab-len-dex versus len-dex with the treatment continued until disease progression. So this trial clearly showed, again, adding the monoclonal antibody to lenalidomide dexamethasone increases the depth of response, significantly improves the progression-free survival. We don't have data on the overall survival yet, and also has almost a threefold increase in the MRD negativity rate. And this data is very similar to what we saw in the relapse setting as well, so very consistent. Now, how does it change practice? I think this certainly gives an option for the transplant-ineligible patient population for an injection therapy. So now we have two trials. I think the daralendex and the bortezomib-lendex both appear to be good three-drug combinations for the transplant-ineligible patient population.
And we'll get into how this plays out, particularly in the older patient, and we're going to start talking about making decisions in a second. But just one more trial I sort of want to get out on the table, or at least a concept, and I think there was already a question about this in the chat room, which is the use of KRD DARA. Saji, can you comment on this master trial?
Yeah, no, I think the master trial, the important message, not as much as the DARA KRD, as much as it is about the probably the way we would decide duration of therapy in the future. So the trial essentially, you know, was designed to say you're going to treat patients with DARA KRD injection therapy. They're all going to get a stem cell transplant, and then they are going to get a DARA KRD consolidation for four cycles. But if you have two MRD negative tests between any of these phases beyond the transplant, you're going to come off therapy and be observed. And I think this is, you know, it's a very interesting hypothesis-generating trial. And they were able to show that, you know, with this approach, nearly 80% of the patients were able to be MRD negative. So I think with longer-term follow-up, I think we'll get a sense if this is the way of the future.
And I'm curious, Nupur, what you see as the future of MRD measurements. Do you think it's ready right now to come into clinical practice? And what are some of the, this is really an interesting approach. What are some of the other trial approaches, Nupur, that are incorporating MRD into it?
So I think this is the first step towards actually using MRD to tailor therapy. So up until now, you know, we've always said MRD is useful to assess the depth of response, and we've shown that over and over again. And we've also shown very nicely that MRD negativity correlates really well with, is a good prognostic marker. If you're MRD negative, you're going to have a better survival. You're going to have a better disease-free survival. Now, the MASTER trial is a real new generation of a trial, which we think is going to be the future, wherein we are using MRD to actually either up-titrate or get rid of treatment. And that is actually extremely important when you start combining four drugs, because when do you stop? There is, you know, we can keep adding drugs, but there is an issue of cumulative toxicity of all of these drugs that you combine. And there's also the piece about financial toxicity. And there may be a subset of patients who, after whether it's two negative MRDs or whatever the number is, that we could actually consider stopping treatment when we are starting to use four drugs. So I think this is a really a neat design of a clinical trial. And we do have a lot of trials designed in a similar way, wherein we are going to tailor how we maintain patients who are MRD negative versus MRD positive.
So we're going to put out another question to the audience, and just pretty straightforward question. Yeah, what's your upfront therapy right now, nowadays for pre-transplant induction situation in a patient with high-risk features? And while we're waiting for them to respond, Saji, a couple questions came up in the, again, the chat room. I think it's interesting. Quote, what about higher infection rates with Dara VRD? First of all, is that true, Saji?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do see infections with these drug combinations. It's again numerically higher, and I think this is really, you know, the phase two trial wasn't really powered to have a very definite conclusion as to, you know, we are seeing a significantly higher infection rate. But we do know there is increased risk of infections, lung infections especially, and reactivation of hepatitis associated with retimumab. So certainly that needs to be taken into account. And, you know, based on some of the data from the UK group, you know, many of us are using first 2 to 3 months of antibiotic prophylaxis for these patients anyway.
So the most common answer still is RBD. We see some KRD, but we also see a fair amount of Dara plus. So a little bit of a spectrum there. Newport, a couple more questions from the audience about MRD, flow or NGS, Newport.
So I don't think it matters. I think it's important to report on the sensitivity. I think most of us are using 10 times minus 6 now, and you have next generation flow or next generation sequencing. So whatever is available locally would be okay, as long as you know what the sensitivity is.
So Saji, a patient comes off therapy due to MRD negativity, then you test them again at some point. Now they're MRD positive, but not in progression by MWG criteria. Would you retreat based on the loss of MRD, Saji?
At this point, no, because there's clearly no data to suggest that that kind of early intervention would be appropriate for all patients. Now, having said that, if I have somebody with multiple high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities, a young patient with, let's say, 414 translocation and a 17p deletion, and where the target really was to keep them in MRD negative state and is now becoming positive, I might have that discussion with the patient about starting therapy again.
So we do surveys on all of, when we do all these meetings of oncologists in practice. So I'll show you, they actually answer the upfront question we just gave the audience almost exactly the same as the audience. But the other question we want to put out to the audience is, what about the older patient? So 80-year-old patient, normal renal function, no high-risk features. And Newport, you know, here's where we're hearing people talk about Dara, Lendex, and RVD Light. I have heard people say they look at risk in making that decision. But again, a Newport, an otherwise healthy 80-year-old, how do you think it through?
So again, an 80-year-old, you look for other comorbidities and what they can tolerate. Both RBD Light and DARA-RD are perfectly reasonable combinations in the upfront setting. I do tend to use a proteasome inhibitor-containing regimen in a patient with high-risk cytogenetics. So if they have FISH criteria for high-risk, I would preferentially use RBD Light. Otherwise, RD-DARA is perfectly fine.
And it's interesting that the audience, and you'll see in a second, our polling still says RBD Light as being the most common or more commonly utilized, at least by the audience, for example, than RD Dara. Also, and this actually came up in the chat room, Saji, the high-risk patient, we said del-17P. When we asked again our poll, we saw RBD, KRD. How do you approach the high-risk situation, Saji, outside a trial setting?
Yeah, no, I think our practice as a group, we decided that, you know, our risk stratification approach was that patients with high-risk disease should have the regimen that will give the deepest response. So our current approach is to use DARA-RVD for a transplant-eligible patient for induction if they are high-risk disease, and then go to transplant and then maintain them with a bortezomib blend combination.
Quick question, a new pour, RVD light with R, is it 15 or 25 milligrams?
15.
Right. So Sashi actually has a patient. We want to just briefly present to sort of get into some of the principles. Again, he does a fantastic job in this presentation, and we're going to post it in the next week or so. Really recommend. He goes through a lot of the granularity of how he thinks these through. But Sashi, maybe you could just sort of summarize that by talking a little bit about the 67-year-old man.
Absolutely. So it's a 67-year-old male, newly diagnosed myeloma, and clearly has high-risk disease with the basis of the 414 translocation. PET scan shows FDG-avid lesions, no soft tissue involvement. So the question is, what do you do next for this transplant-eligible patient without any significant comorbidities who presents with high-risk disease?
So maybe you could just kind of briefly talk about this. Again, you go into it in great depth, but Sashi, some of the key things you think about in this situation.
Right. So I think it's important, especially now that we have so many different choices in terms of treatment for myeloma patients, not only in the upfront setting, but also what you're going to be doing in the relapse setting. Think about the factors, things that you would run through in your mind. So obviously the age is important. We just talked about with the RVD light, the frailty, performance status, the same issues. Comorbidities always have to be taken into account in these patients in case your therapy is going to worsen the pre-existing problems. So if you have neuropathy, maybe you want to avoid bortezomib. As the old patients get older, the social support and the insurance issues really drive how often they can show up in your clinic for treatment. So those need to be taken into account when you decide on the regimen. Increasingly, I think we are starting to use the disease characteristics as well, and we clearly know that patients who have high-risk disease, we are going to treat them slightly differently, maybe not to some extent the drug specifically, because we want to include a proteasome inhibitors in patients with high-risk disease. We also want to target a deepest possible response in those patients, given the fact that the outcomes are better when they get to be MRD negative, with the caveat that it still remains to be proven in the prospective setting that if you have myeloma, high risk or standard risk, driving a given patient to a given depth of response is going to change the outcome for that singular patient. But based on what we know, I think it's, and the poor outcome in the high risk patients, I think it's safe to extrapolate based on the data that we have and say we want to achieve MRD negativity for those high risk patients.
Nupur, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think I agree completely. It's that one patient population where I would still do MRD testing, because oftentimes you folks want to know who are the patients where you would be doing MRD testing, probably only the high-risk patients, because as Shaji's pointed out, you do want to get a deep response in this patient population.
So we're going to just briefly talk about the management of relapse disease, and just get into that again. We're going to put out a question to the audience. And what's your usual treatment recommendation for a patient who starts out with RBD, transplant, and then maintenance lenalidomide? We said one for a year and a half before there's asymptomatic biochemical relapse. And let's just assume the patient needs to be treated. We can talk about that. And here you can see how our survey people responded. Sashi, can you talk a little bit about how you think through the patient who has a biochemical relapse, and also the role of observation in this situation?
Absolutely. So I think, it's kind of the similar situation that we face when we have somebody with a high-risk smoldering myeloma to some extent. Some of these patients with biochemical relapse alone, especially if they have standard risk, can continue on a very slow trajectory of biochemical, increasing M protein, sometimes even for years in the post-transplant setting. So I don't think we should jump into treatment for every patient based on biochemical progression. The places where I would certainly consider immediate reinstitution of therapy would be the patients with high-risk cytogenetics, the patients who presented with renal dysfunction, or patient who presented with neurological complications, where I think the room for error is much, much narrower, where I would certainly start therapy. for the standard risk patients, if you continue to watch the tempo of the M-spike, and if you see that the M-spike's doubling in 3 months or 6 months, then I think we would start getting worried and maybe start them on therapy. In terms of the specific regimen, I think one thing to keep in mind is to expose the patient to a drug or drug class that they have not been exposed to before. So for someone who is relapsing on a lenalidomide-based maintenance therapy, you know, I would think about using a monoclonal antibody with a proteasome inhibitor, or at least if you want to use a IMID, the next generation IMID like pomalidomide, in combination with a PI or a monoclonal antibody. And of course, the usual things that we talked about before also had to be taken into account, both patient-based and disease-based characteristics.
So, Nupur, I always love it when somebody takes a shot at really putting out their, you know, their own personal algorithm. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how Saji sort of thought through putting this together and sort of how you think through some of these alternatives, particularly something like elotuzumab, for example. Nupur, where does that fit into your menu, so to speak?
So good question and a tough question, I think. You know, what's happened right now is, I think in the upfront setting, we're using triplets, and now on clinical trials, we're doing quadruplets. Typically, the time of first relapse has kind of gone to between 3 and 4 years is where the majority of patients relapse. And then you absolutely have to take into account some of the things which Shaji has talked about. So things like, were they on Rev maintenance and are they Rev refractory? What was their previous treatment? What was the toxicity from their previous treatment before coming up with a therapeutic strategy? And the data we have with the elotuzumab so far is, you know, the POM elotuzumab DEX study looks good. So if somebody is looking at starting pomalidomide, combining it with elotuzumab may be reasonable, but the problem with that data is we have a lot of other combinations with pomalidomide, such as daratumumab, such as bortezomib, there's carfilzomib also. So you have a bunch of approved regimens with pomalidomide. In my practice, though, if you're going to be thinking of using elotuzumab, use it early, because in the very relapse refractory state, the chances of elotuzumab working are probably low.
So I want to move on in a second and talk about all the new exciting developments, but I did want to get Saji's final comments, because some of the things you thought through here I just think are very, very important, and also to maybe rethink a lot of these in the COVID era, so to speak. Any comments on some of these logistic issues, Saji? And also I'm curious about your experience with sub-Q Dara.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the overriding principle, I think, in the COVID era is, you know, how can we reduce the frequency of clinic visits for these patients? Given that there's no data to say, you know, one specific drug should not be or should be used, the question is essentially, how convenient can we make it? So I think a lot of us have tried switching patients who are on bortezomib, for example, to ixazomib or so which basically, you know, gives you the oral proteasome inhibition advantage without having to come into the clinic weekly or twice weekly. The subcutaneous daratumumab just started getting used, and I think that would also be important in terms of reducing the duration that these patients would have to spend in the clinic. So it's a question of tweaking the regimens, and sometimes even dose reducing the drugs, which might cause more toxicity. So if somebody is on 4 milligrams of pomalidomide and verging on, you know, on the verge of neutropenia, I might go to 2 milligrams so that there is no risk of, one, them coming into the clinic with neutropenic fever into the ER and getting exposed, and two, not having to come into the clinic weekly to check their CBC. So I think a lot of it is more, you know, common sense logistic approach, the changes that we would make with the treatments. But I think at the end of the day, it's still the overriding thing should be that the myeloma should be kept controlled.
Yeah, well, it's interesting in terms of, you know, what you hear about these various issues that you're bringing up. Well, what about ixazomib, Nupur? When I first heard about it, it just sounded so great, particularly in the maintenance setting. I'm not sure how it's actually gotten translated into practice, both as induction as well as maintenance therapy. What are your experiences with it, Nupur, and any issues in terms of tolerability? Initially, you're hearing about some GI things. How does that actually play out?
So ixazomib, as Sharji's pointed out, is the oral proteasome inhibitor. And again, if used early, we've seen it to be extremely efficacious when combined with lenalidomide. The beauty of ixazomib is it has a really long half-life and can be given on a weekly dosing schedule. So that really is good for patients. There is a little bit of GI toxicity, so nausea, vomiting, some diarrhea. But in general, that is extremely well managed with a little bit of dexamethasone and making sure you haven't eaten anything for an hour and a half or 2 hours. Outside of that, again, you know, the nice thing about ixazomib is it's got a fairly forgiving label so that you can actually go to ixazomib as soon as you start having toxicity from bortezomib in terms of neuropathy. If you are maintaining somebody specifically with high-risk cytogenetics on every other week of bortezomib, switching them to ixazomib is perfectly reasonable. In fact, it is a good drug in the COVID era in the upfront setting, doing something like IRD. It's just not approved upfront right now, and that's where the challenge is. But transitioning quickly to the oral drug is good, and it's generally extremely well tolerated.
Yeah, and that comment Saji made about avoiding neutropenia, we're hearing that all throughout oncology right now. I don't know how much data there is, but people are just, you know, solid tumors, et cetera. All right, let's talk about new things in myeloma, and there are lots of them, as there always have been for a long time. This is a great slide that Newport put together talking about some of the things particularly that happened in the last couple of years in terms of what's been going on in practice. But I just want to get a little bit more of a feel about some of these new IMiDs. You know, last I left it, there was like, you know, Cereblon was out there. But when I saw the ASCO virtual presentation, I can see a lot more has been learned about these new class of drugs. And there was a new one actually presented at ASCO. Newport, can you comment a little bit about this new class or the new types of IMiDs that we're starting to see and how they differ compared to, for example, lenalidomide and pomalidomide?
Sure. So the new class of the immunomodulatory drugs, or now called the cell mods, is the better term used here. And what they are is a lot more potent than both lenalidomide and pomalidomide. And you can see that in that table, because you know that lenalidomide and pomalidomide binds to that cereblon, which you see out there in that little pocket. And by doing so, it then degrades some of these transcription factors, which are downstream of cereblon, specifically Icarus and Iolus. And if you look at Len and Palm, they can do it at the doses represented there. But iberdomide, which is one of the new kids on the block now, a new cell mod, and the other one which you're talking about is CC92480, again, a very potent cell mod, is able to block these or able to cause these proteins to degrade at really nanomolar concentrations and yet maintaining their immunomodulatory function. So this was a trial which was presented by Paul at this year's ASCO, and CC92480 is a new cell mod which is extremely potent. And the nice thing is it's extremely well tolerated as well. And it can be combined with a lot of the backbone drugs that we already know work in myeloma, including bortezomib, daratumumab, or carfilzomib. And the beauty of this is all of these patients who go on to these trials have been exposed previously to both lenalidomide and pomalidomide, and yet you're seeing responses when you combine bortezomib with this new cell mod. So, you know, every time we use one of these immunomodulatory drugs as maintenance and as continuous therapy, I think everybody in the audience is always concerned about, well, if I use it continuously, I'm going to make my patient resistant to it and they're not going to have anything left. And then soon thereafter, we come up with a new drug. So this is actually really quite remarkable data, and more to come with this.
Saji, this was a still shot of this incredible animation that Phil McCarthy did for the ASCO discussion. It was the last I saw it, it was just like Cereblon. Now, you know, this wild thing with all these things happening. Maybe you can translate for that and some of this for those of us who are not up to date on some of the biology. Also, your perception in terms of how this is going to affect the field moving forward, Saji.
Yeah, it's interesting how the field has evolved. I mean, considering the fact that thalidomide was serendipity in terms of its discovery and use in myeloma, then came the lenalidomide and pomalidomide, which are minor tweaks of the same molecule. And finally, now we are really using the biology that we learned over a decade in designing these molecules, where we are really going after the mechanism of action of the IMiDs. So by, again, degrading the Aiolos and the Ikaros, clearly we are kind of hitting the pathway directly and still reaping all the benefits that we have with that class of drug. Obviously, this is all being studied in the setting of relapsed disease. The key is going to be knowing, are these going to replace some of those current IMiDs? If so, at what stage, right from the beginning in newly diagnosed, versus is it going to be more in the setting of relapsed disease? And these all have powerful immunomodulatory drugs. And with all the immunotherapy platforms that are evolving, the big question is, this might make a huge difference to the field, even more so than the immunomodulatory drugs we currently use in the clinic.
And also very attractive to think about them being better tolerated. Let's talk a little bit about venetoclax, Nupur. You can imagine how much we're talking about it when we talk about CLL and AML nowadays. I mean, just completely changing everything. The big phase 3 trial in AML just came out at EHA a couple weeks ago, positive for survival. What about venetoclax and myeloma, Nupur? It's had kind of an interesting journey, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. And we're still sorting out that interesting journey. And, a lot of this work has been done by Shaji here. So a lot of the credit to all of this data goes to Shaji, actually. Venetoclax, as you all know, targets BCL2. And if you think about proapoptotic proteins or survival proteins in myeloma, BCL2 and MCL1 play a big role. Most of us believe that MCL1 is the driver in the majority of myeloma, but there's a subset of myelomas where BCL2 overexpression plays a significant role. Venetoclax targets BCL2 and by doing so can cause cell death. Shaji was the one who first showed us that venetoclax in combination with dexamethasone actually has an overall response rate which is significant. It's about 60%. And his early data actually showed that if you look at patients who have high BCL2 expression in that patient population, they are the ones who actually have this activity, and that those patients were largely patients who had the 1114 translocation. This sort of led to the large randomized trial, which was the Bellini trial, and the Bellini trial took all comers initially, looking at both progression-free survival and overall survival. And unfortunately, the Bellini trial had to be stopped because of a survival disadvantage when you looked at all patients, despite the fact that the PFS was better. And this was largely because of toxicity seen and death seen in patients who were getting venetoclax and bortezomib dexamethasone. So going back to what Shaji had done in his early studies and looking to see whether it made a difference in the 1114 translocated patients, this data was actually looked at in the Bellini trial. And if you look at the 1114 translocated patients, there was a very, very significant benefit in terms of overall response in these patients. Patients were actually achieving CR and also MRD negative state. And this actually translated into a significant improvement in progression-free survival. And there was no overall survival disadvantage seen in this 1114 translocated patient population. So although Bellini had to be stopped because of the survival disadvantage, we all do think this is a niche drug for a specific patient population, and that patient population may be the 1114 translocated patients.
So I want to get Saji's take on this. When I first started hearing about this trial, Saji, I was flashing. I remember they used to talk about, suppose trastuzumab had been used in everybody, not the 20% of people who had HER2. All you would have seen is cardiac toxicity, you would have lost the whole thing. I kind of thought about when I started to see this trial get ironed out. Can you comment on the study? And also, Saji, sort of the pathophysiology in your mind of why people with 1114 do respond?
So yeah, let's talk about the mechanism first. The patients with 1114 translocation, which is about 15 to 20% of myeloma patients, tend to have more of a B-cell-like plasma cell. They tend to have high expression of BCL2, and they tend to be more dependent on the BCL2 compared to the other proteins in the BCL2 family. And by using the BCL2-specific inhibition, we are able to get a much more potent anti-myeloma effect in the 1114 translocated patients. And what we see also, as Nupur already pointed out, when you add the dexamethasone to the mix, what we do is essentially called a BCL2 priming phenomenon, where the beam is entirely shifted towards BCL2. And that makes it even more dependent on BCL2. And then when venetoclax comes in, it can effectively kill these myeloma cells. Now, with respect to the Bellini trial, I think one of the interesting observations we had was, obviously, the patients with 1114 translocations had all the benefit and really no harm done to them. In contrast, the patients who were not 1114 translocated and also had a low BCL2 expression, and especially those with high-risk cytogenetics in combination, those are the patients who appear to have no benefit whatsoever, but also had that increased mortality. So I think going forward, hopefully the ongoing studies will prove that this is a drug to be used in the 1114 translocated patients. But digging into the physiology, I suspect that there's going to be another 20-30% of patients who have high BCL2 expressors, despite not having 1114, who might also benefit from this. But that will need some kind of a biomarker that we can use in the clinic.
So just a quick follow-up, you know, here you talking about BCL2 assays, and, you know, is there any future for using this type of assay or any kind of assay to pick out people in general who benefit from these agents?
Absolutely. I think venetoclax is a great story for myeloma, and I think it is it kind of makes us think twice when you have more targeted agents come up in future. Instead of doing all-comer trials, we really have to select groups which might benefit the most. So I think for the BCL2 story, definitely a biomarker that can tell us who are those BCL2-dependent myelomas will be very helpful.
So we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about BCMA strategies, and particularly CAR-T. Nupur, maybe you kind of run through sort of the basis of this and where we're using this strategy.
Sure. So unlike the 1114 translocated story, you know, BCMA has turned out to be a really very good target because it is an antigen which is essentially expressed on all plasma cells, all myeloma cells. BCMA, as you all know, stands for B-cell maturation antigen. It belongs to the TNF superfamily. And as your B-cells mature, you start getting more and more of an expression of BCMA. So if you thinking about sort of targeted approaches to take care of something, you want an antigen which is actually present on all cancer cells. In this case, BCMA is expressed on all myeloma cells. You want very little of this antigen expressed on normal cells. It doesn't really get expressed on normal B cells, but it does get expressed on very mature B cells and also on plasma cells, normal plasma cells. So ideal target, and there's a lot of different strategies that we're using to target BCMA. I think the one which is sort of furthermost in its development is the antibody drug conjugate, belantamab mafodotin. This is a conjugate, BCMA drug conjugate, which is a completely humanized, if you phosphorylated IgG1 antibody, and it has the warhead of MMAF, which causes all the killing. And there's a whole bunch of DREAM trials, and this one is the most recent. This is the DREAM 2 trial, which was has been now published by Sagar Lonial, wherein they looked at two different doses of belantamab. They looked at a dose of 2.5 mg per kg and 3.4 mg per kg. And the dosing was largely done because of some ocular toxicity and thrombocytopenia seen at the earlier 3.4 mg per kg. And that was what prompted this two dosing strategy. If you look back at the two dosing strategies, you know, the overall response rate of both doses was quite similar. I think the big toxicities which were seen still was the ocular toxicity. So keratopathy is seen in 75% of people people, which is not trivial. And the other piece which was seen was thrombocytopenia seen in all cohorts of this patient population.
Sajid, any comments on belantamab mafodotin? We mentioned the fact that tomorrow we're doing this program on gynecologic cancers. They have tisotumab vedotin, and they also have these kind of strange, to me, strange ophthalmic issues. You see that with some of these different antibody drug conjugates, all kinds of eye problems. What's been your experience, both the efficacy and tolerability, Sajid, with this agent?
So I think, the belantamab clearly tells us that the BCMA is a great target for myeloma. We certainly see good efficacy. The DREAM 2 trial had over 30% of the patients responding to the therapy and in a group of patients who are heavily pretreated. So I think from an efficacy standpoint, it's clearly an effective agent. The second part about efficacy, it appears to be quite durable responses. We see many of these patients, despite going off therapy due to toxicity, are still maintaining response. The toxicity is going to be something that we have to good at managing. The ocular toxicity, nearly 70% of these patients in these studies did have some degree of keratopathy that was visible on clinical examination. About 30% of the patients had symptomatic eye issues related to the drug. Now, we don't know whether those patients who had the keratopathy only on clinical exam would have gone on to have symptoms if we continue to dose them. The trials were designed to hold the therapy until the keratopathy improved. But nevertheless, it tells us, eye is a target organ here that we really need to be careful about. It also brings up the question, maybe different dosing schedules might be appropriate for this as we go forward, maybe more intense upfront and less as we get responses.
Interesting. So let's finish out talking about CAR-T. It's been a topic we've been talking about in myeloma the last couple years. And now we saw some great papers presented at this virtual ASCO meeting. Nupur also a terrific presentation that will show some slides from discussing it. Can you just go through the three major studies or data sets that were presented at ASCO and sort of summarize where we are right now with CAR-T and myeloma, Nupur?
Sure. So the KARMA trial was presented by Nikhil Manchi. This is the phase two pivotal trial, which hopefully will get ide-cel approved. And this was an extension of our phase one clinical trial, more than a total of 128 patients were actually dosed on this clinical trial after being leukapheresed, and the majority of patients, we were actually able to make product. If you look at the data here, all of these patients, we had a response rate depending on the dose. Once they got to more than 150 million cells, all of the majority of them responded, and at 450, about 80% of these patients actually responded. The good news is the PFS in this entire cohort of 128 patients was close to about 9 months or so. But if you look at those patients who achieved a stringent complete response, you saw that their progression-free survival was close to 20 months. I do need to underscore the fact that this was an extremely heavily pretreated patient population. So they were IMID refractory to both LEN and POM and both proteasome inhibitor refractory. And more than 90% of them had also had a CD38 monoclonal antibody. So in general, when you think about that patient population on an average, if you look at the Mammoth trial, for example, their PFS is generally less than 3 months. So for us to see stringent complete responses in this patient population in a global study and almost mirroring what we saw with the phase one trial, to me, was the reassuring piece here, so that you can do a very designer-specific approach on a global level and yet see the same data that you saw with the phase one trial.
So my goal here is to try to get a more macro view. We're going to put up the three trials that were presented, but then I want to kind of take a step back again from the point of view of docs in practice and kind of figure out where we are in terms of the efficacy as well as the tolerability. So I just want to put out the other trials that were presented. Nupur, any comments on CARTITUDE?
Yeah, this was presented and we can talk about it. The only difference is this has a biepitopic binding as opposed to a single epitope, but very high response rates, as you can see. Evolve
and
again.
Orbicel.
Yeah, Orvacel, first time we saw sort of long-term data with Orvacel, also very similar. The difference between Orvacel and Ide-cel is this focuses on a ratio of CD4 and CD8 cells in the final product.
So this is one of the slides from Dr. Patel from MD Anderson, who did a fantastic talk trying to summarize all these. And again, we kind of want to just get a macro view of this. But just first, quick question from the audience, Saji. Someone wants to know, how long is the time between apheresis and an infusion of the manufactured products? How does it compare with the lymphomas with CD19 versus myeloma?
So in terms of the duration, it is, depending upon the particular product, the trial we're looking at, anywhere from almost 3 weeks to 4 weeks in most of these settings. And in terms of the manufacturing process, they're very similar. So I don't know. I think the duration is the same for lymphoma and myeloma trials at this point. Certainly, there are new technologies being looked at, trying to see if we can shorten them down to 12 to 14 days in terms of manufacturing process.
And we'll talk also about sort of off-the-shelf products that are being looked at. But just go back to this slide that sort of summarizes it. And again, I'm still trying to think macro here in Nieuwpoint. Like, for example, do you see the kind of cures that you see with diffuse large B-cell? Initially, it seemed like you all were like super excited. Then last year, I was thinking, well, maybe you're not so excited. And with ASCO, it sounded like you're excited again. I don't know if this has to do with who's getting treated or whatever, but Nieuwpoint, can you kind of put it in context?
Sure. I'm just going to say that I'm still excited, Neil. And
You never stop being excited, right?
No, that's right. And I think the big thing here on this slide is all the trials have a very similar patient population, and we are seeing extremely high response rates, 80%+ of patients responding. And remember, these are very, very heavily pre-treated patients. Obviously, we are not seeing the flattening of the curve like you saw with the lymphoma patients, and that I do think is largely to do with the biology of the disease. The one thing I will highlight again on the slide you've shown is the safety. When we first went into this, we were concerned about the safety, and if you look at all three trials, the safety is comparable. The amount of CRS neurotoxicity is hardly seen. The slight difference with the HLH is seen with EVOLVE and the CARTITUDE trials. In terms of efficacy, as I pointed out, the longest follow-up is with the KarMMa data, but in end-stage disease, we've started to see PFSs close to 20 months. So as we get these treatments earlier on in the myeloma paradigm, I'm sure we're going to do a lot better.
So, Sashi, any comments on tolerability? Initially, it sounded like maybe the cytokine release and neurologic issues were not as great as what was seen with CD19. Is that still kind of the case? And how old can the patient be to be able to get through these therapies? It seems like this is not like transplant, that maybe older patients can get through this.
Definitely. I think, in terms of the CRS and other toxicities, especially the neurotoxicity, certainly doesn't seem to be as high as what one would have expected based on the prior data from lymphoma. But I think the important thing is, again, as Nupur pointed out, we are not seeing the durability of response that we anticipated by going into this late-stage disease, but going earlier on, the story might be entirely different. But in terms of the toxicity management, it's a learning curve. I think we are all starting to get more comfortable managing these patients, and the more comfortable we get, the older the patients we will be able to take on for this therapy. So I think that's a moving target right now. Is there an age limit? I think if somebody has good functional status and good organ functions at this point, I think most of us would feel comfortable taking them on for a clinical trial with the CAR-T.
And I guess maybe the enthusiasm for this Nieuwpoint might be reflected. I was surprised when we chatted that you were saying that even with COVID, you were putting people through CAR-T because this is really the chance that they have. Any comments on that and some of the benefits that you see play out even right now, Nieuwpoint?
Yeah, so, you know, we talked about this in the COVID era. I think one of the biggest thing is to get your disease under good control. So somebody who has relapsed refractory disease without a lot of other options, this is sort of a one and done approach. They were hospitalized. We did, obviously, for CAR T cells, had to take special permission because, you know, it does, we have to make sure that we have enough ICU beds for somebody who's going through CAR T cells. And the other important thing we had to look into was make sure that a pharmacy had enough tocilizumab, because as you know, toci is used for COVID as well. We were actually testing our patients for COVID before coming in, and we were only starting the lymphodepleting chemotherapy if they were COVID negative. But this was one of those trials where if it works for a patient, it really makes a big difference, because for the first time you get one treatment and then you're no therapy thereafter. So we did take this into account, and we thought it was high priority for us to continue with doing CAR T cells during COVID.
So just out of curiosity, Nupur, what's the age of the oldest patient that you've given CAR T? And is there, if somebody's in otherwise good condition, would you give CAR T to a 90-year-old?
I don't know about 90-year-old, but certainly I think the oldest we've treated is in their 80s. And I think that's kind of the difference between thinking about an autologous transplant versus CAR T cells. And the only reason why we are doing it in the older patient population now is, as Shaji pointed out, we've gotten more comfortable because we haven't seen as much toxicity. So obviously, because of that, we are able to do treatment in these patients.
So I knew this hour was going to fly by like 30 seconds with you two, and it certainly has. It's been great. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks to our audience. Have a great evening. Be safe and stay well.